and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is June 1st, 2023, and this is episode 381. And you're listening to Radio War Nerd at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd, where you can subscribe, get the newsletter, the RSS feed, and so on. Anyway, I'm Mark Ames here in Western New York, where the pooch has been making everyone sneeze and miserable. We have what the Russians call pooch. It's, I think it's poplar tree puke, basically, you know, a puff. Anyway, I'm on the line with the Warnerd himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Puglia. John, how are you doing?
Tired. I mean, I'm tired. We're in another Puglian town. I don't even want to go into specifics, but another town and another, let's see, three hotels in the last 24 hours because they're all changing their schedule. So, yeah, I'm a little tired.
Well, you know, the one good thing to come out of this, and I'm not saying it was worth it, but for us consumers is good, is that you put together, which we're finalizing at some point, a great compendium of edited Warnerd newsletters that are focused, that have, you know, a big travel theme to them. So it's sort of the Warnerd, your travels, which you've been like on the road nonstop for the last 8 years. And Puglia, you know, there are a few of them on Puglia. They're very interesting, fascinating background stories on the Puglia region and the Adriatic Sea region and stuff. So I don't know if there's one good thing to it. It's given you some good stories to tell. But
yeah, if you enjoy the Adriatic region or gastrointestinal upsets, it's the book for you.
Yes, a lot of vomiting, a lot of diarrhea, sour stomach, but also a lot of references to historical atrocities. Slave raidings and various massacres. All the good stuff that you expect from the Warnerd. Anyway, we have with us today, back with us, one of our favorite Radio Warnerd guests and friend of the show, Amr. Amr is, first of all, welcome to the show, Amr.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thanks, guys. It's been a while.
It has been. Although, as I told folks, you very generously bought me some beer at when I took the family out to Toronto, and it was great meeting you.
Yeah, you have a good time here? I knew you guys went to the aquarium.
The kids loved it. It was surprisingly very expensive in Toronto. I don't know why I say surprisingly, because it is the New York of Canada, but it was a lot more expensive than Montreal, but also way closer, so it's worth the trade-off.
Yeah, it is. It is a very pricey city. Like living here is like the combination, the worst parts of New York and then San Francisco in terms of like pricing and real estate and things like that.
Yeah,
I remember when I lived in Canada, I had guests, and one of them said, "You know, things seem really expensive here." And then I tell myself, "It's the exchange rate," and then I do the math and like, no, it's really expensive here.
Yeah. I mean, it's still like slightly cheaper, I guess, than New York, but it was just, that was a bit of a surprise. But we really liked taking the family there. It was a good place to take the family. The aquarium stuff. And we'd like to go back sort of midsummer when they have more of the kind of water parks and all that stuff open. It's a good getaway. We liked it a lot, so... and they don't check check your passport to see if it's expired. So you got to love that. Right. So Amr reached out to us a little while back, saying that or proposing doing an episode on soccer hooliganism or soccer fandom as a kind of as a version of warfare, war.
Yeah, I believe I paraphrased it by saying that football is war by other means.
Yes,
as the great, what's his name? But Bismarck said.
Right. And we, I guess for purposes of the show, we'll call it football, since Americans are the only ones that call it soccer. So we'll call it football.
I think that quote is Clausewitz, though. But
Sorry. I always get them confused.
Yeah.
But no, it totally makes sense. I mean, I've thought that too, and it makes sense. And there are actual, you know, pipelines from soccer hooliganism into, let's say, irregular paramilitaries.
Let's call them, say, the Azov Battalion, or
right sector.
I wanted to touch on that.
And the Russian Volunteer Corps, too. But yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
What was the Russian? There's a Russian word for it called Okolo Futbola, which is supposed to be like besides football.
Yeah, but like football adjacent, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. But it's like it's the name referring to the scene in Russia and Eastern Europe where like hooligans will like meet in a forest and it's like 100 versus 100 battles of like fighting, fist fight, essentially.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is
me. Yeah, well, apparently there's a school of sociology which attributes hooliganism to the decline of the British Empire and the post-war growth of the organized hooliganism for particular teams in the what I guess is the British League, or maybe there are several leagues, I don't know.
But, yeah, I mean, it's a pyramid. It's a British pyramid of leagues, one above the other.
Mm. Okay, but I just wanted to mention the names just because they're really cool. And I just found this in an article about the prime of football hooliganism in the UK, I guess, which was the 1970s. Arsenal, the Herd. Aston Villa, Villa Hardcore. Birmingham City, Zulu Warriors. Blackpool, the Muckers. Burnley, Suicide Squad. Derby County, Lunatic Fringe. Cardiff City, Soul Crew. Charlton Athletic, B-Mob. Chelsea, Headhunters.
Hey! That's me. I did speak to a former headhunter here in Toronto once in a bar, but that's a whole other story altogether. Keep going.
Okay. So, Everton, Road Cutters. That's kind of a letdown. Road Cutters, come on. Hull City, Psychos. Leeds United, Service Crew. Middlesbrough, Frontline. Yeah, there you go, Frontline. Millwall, Bushwhackers. Newcastle United, Gremlins. Nottingham Forest, Executive Crew. Manchester United, Red Army, interestingly.
Nothing to do with the Soviet army, by the way. That's just
nothing to do with Abramovich.
Portsmouth, 657 Crew. Is that a train, perhaps, that, you know, gets you to Portsmouth? I don't know. Queen's Park Rangers, Bush Babies, Tottenham Hotspur. Mark, Yid Army.
This is like the London so Tottenham is the London club that was for always associated with like Jewish people. It was in the Jewish area of London, and other fans would, you know, pejoratively call them the Yids. And so they sort of
reclaimed the N-word. All right, I like that. I can call it that, but you can't.
Sheffield United, Blades Business Crew. And even I know the reference of that because I remember that Joe Strummer song. I'm not generally a Joe Strummer fan, but I love that last song he did. This is England, this life of Sheffield Steel. Yeah, so that's where the Blade comes from. And then Shrewsbury, Borderfront, Stoke City, Naughty 40, which only rhymes in an English accent, I get. For me, it would be Naughty 40. That doesn't really work. Sunderland, Seaburn Casuals, I don't know. Large question mark appears over my head there.
They West may not Ham- do too well in fights, I'm assuming. Maybe they don't even do fights.
Hey, you're spoiling the casuals.
I could touch on this when we get into like syntax, but casuals is a word used in England to refer to like football ultras. And the reason is that there's an overlap with like casual fashion. So like ultras counterintuitively tend not to wear like the jerseys of the club they support, because the whole thing is, how do you say it? Like, it's like the black block technique, right? It's a black block strategy of like, you wear casual shirts, jeans, nothing identifying, nothing particularly distinguished, so that when you get into fights with other fans, yes, you can't be identified by security, by witnesses, etc.
When hence, you break casuals. Things and people,
riots and so on, in. Yeah.
So actually the casuals are actually scarier than the people who are like, I am the Crossbones Killer McGee.
Yes, essentially. You know? Yeah.
Okay. Oh, they missed out on Crossbones. That was a good ultra name. Yeah. But yeah, this kind of brings us to one of the stories that we're going to talk about, which is headlined, Stabbed Millwall Fan Recounts Fight with London Bridge Attackers. And the weirdest thing, this is a fight between a Millwall fan and one of three jihadis who started stabbing people in central London.
Oh, yeah.
And the weird thing is, one of the jihadis was dressed in an Arsenal shirt. And I don't even know if that interacted with the Millwall supporters' rage or if he was angry just because, you know, the guy was going around stabbing everybody. But
I don't mind if you stab people, but that fucking Arsenal shirt.
Wearing a football jersey is like the opposite of being casual. It's like, it's like, look at this fucking loser wearing the jersey instead of wearing like black t-shirt, jeans, and maybe like a hoodie of some kind of parka or a bomber jacket. My favorite part of that story is the guy goes after a guy with a knife and he yells, fuck you, I'm Millwall, which is,
I know.
So
he really did
do that. Yeah, that's crazy.
And he got seriously stabbed too. And,
Millwall do have a reputation, by the way, in terms of like casuals in England. Millwall are particularly notorious for their violence. Them and their rivals, West Ham's Intercity firm, the ICF.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He said, okay, Roy Larner, 47. By the way, age is another interesting thing.
Yeah.
These guys are not all young by any means.
Because they come out of the scene in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, right? So the casual scene, the fighting scene, whatever you want to call it, at least in England and in the UK, it pretty much got clamped down on in the late 80s, 90s, especially after Hazel and Hillsborough. So the people that belong to that scene are the people that started in that scene in the 70s and 80s. So there's not a lot of, I don't want to say there's a lot of young people. There are, but it's primarily like, you know, Billy, 47, from Brixton or whatever.
Right. You're talking about the British soccer hooligans.
Yes. The rest
not
of the
in other
Europe.
Countries.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
because Thatcher really cracked down on them. Like some of the, and a lot of other countries are now using the British model to crack down on their hooligans now, unless they plan to weaponize them, like Ukraine, which we can get into. But for most countries, they use the British model, which is like long sentencing, stadium bans. When your team is playing, you have to go to the police station to check in before the game and then during halftime. If your team is playing away in Europe at another country, you have to hand in your passport to the local police station. It's ways to like, it was pretty much ways to crush the casual scene by Thatcher and the Tories.
Yeah, I remember an Oi song about that. It was a very whiny, self-pitying song. Go to football, throw a brick, get no mercy, Munson Nick. And it's like, oh, you poor guy, you threw a brick and they put you in prison? No. Roy Larner, 47, told reporters, he shouted, fuck you, I'm Millwall. I always hear that as Millhouse, and it really doesn't work. I'm Millwall, in an allusion to the club's association with football violence, as he charged into the attackers, these three jihadis, at the Black and Blue restaurant and bar in Borough Market. Is Black and Blue a team color or something, or just is it an S&M bar? I don't know.
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, apparently he went 1-on-3. That's a really impressive, know, you know, yeah. Either he was, yeah.
Best day of his life, I'll bet.
Oh, yeah.
Probably. Getting these stabbed people live and, for this yeah, stuff. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I bet he's got all the articles behind glass hung up on the walls in his house.
You best believe he'll be mentioning this every pub. Yeah. London. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, he's earned it. I mean, give him that. Like,
yeah. Well, and there are still recent incidents, but they don't seem to be purely UK. There was a recent incident of an English fan, a giant fat guy, knocking down, I think, Dutch fans. Like, they'd step up and he'd knock them down. Do you remember that incident, Amr?
Yeah, so this was a couple of weeks ago, actually. West Ham United, a club based in London, was due to play in a European Conference League match against AZ Alkmaar, which is based in the Netherlands. You know, in European competitions, the knockout stages, they have two legs, right? One leg on each in each team's city. The first leg was played in London. West Ham won 1-0, I believe. But then the second leg was played in AZ in the Netherlands. And the AZ lost. This was the semifinals, by the way. Like, whoever won was going to the finals. AZ lost, and their fans, their ultras, quote-unquote, rioted. There are videos of players, like actual West Ham players, fighting with the ultras because they're trying to get to their families in the stands, like in the away section. And the ultras were like, there were punches being thrown, kicks being thrown, etc. And I do want to mention here and touch on this. In Europe, in a lot of parts of Europe, English scalps are seen as particularly valuable because the English are seen as the ones who started the casual hooligan culture. So, like, anytime English fans go abroad, there tends to be violence because local fans want to fight with the English, right? And right. That was translated also, and also there's multiple reasons for what happened here in 2016 when Russia played England in Marseille in Euro 2016. And Russian hooligans were basically rampaging through Marseille, beating English fans up before, during, and after the match. And, you know,
I seem to remember the British press chalked that up as a Putin active measure. Operation and like there was a lot of crazy talk at the time.
Some of it's crazy and some of it the thing is I don't trust the British press in general, like you know, one of the worst types of journalism on the planet, and we can get into that with Hillsborough, but there is something to be said about the connections between Russian hooligans and like the FSB. There was what's his name, Alexander Shpirigin, was a Dynamo Moscow ultra. He set up something called the Union of Russian Firms, and he had connections to the FSB in terms of them being used as muscle for certain, like, you know, occasions, events, like not political rallies and so on, but also to channel the football hooligan violence away from, like, you know, internal conflict towards, like, you know, sending them to Europe to, like, you know, fuck other people up. And there were Russian parliamentarians who said something. I don't remember who said this, but one of them said, I don't see any problem with our manly men, you know, beating the crap out of the English hooligans.
Yeah. There is definitely something to it, and we can talk about it a little later. Like, the soccer hooligans were instrumentalized by Russian police to do dirty stuff, like Moscow police for sure, in the early 2000s. Some of them were then channeled into Nashi. Like, there's some of this. I just mean, like, the idea that a fight between, countries' football hooligans fight all the time. And like they would do that with or without.
Yeah, they don't need the Russian state to tell them to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, the Kremlin, what the FSB did, the FSB hasn't been that, as far as I know, that involved in the hooliganism, but they did at some point sort of force all the hooligan clubs from various teams, Spartak, Dinamo, so on, to have a representative that who would liaise with the FSB because of the Kremlin's paranoia about anything that's outside of its control. And so they wanted to make sure that like they acted within bounds and probably had them do, you know, probably could get them to do other stuff as well. I definitely agree. But I just feel like,
of course.
Yeah, the idea, it may have been
The British press just, love to think, like, the way the British press describe these things, it's always like a metonym for like Putin personally telling them,
exactly,
go attack the good British Tommies in Marseille.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that, Mark. Do you remember a book about Russian football hooligans? I mean, there's Among the Thugs, which was published in 1990. It's by an American, but it's about, his name was Bill Buford, I think, about British soccer hooligans. But then there was a book about Russian soccer hooligans. And many of the interviews revealed that they had this reverence for British football hooligans, but then the British hooligans had been so suppressed by the time the Soviet Union collapsed that when they met them, they were very, very disappointed.
Yeah, because all of this hooligan culture and football in Europe was imported from Britain from the 70s and 80s. That's where it started. Right. It started in Britain in the 70s with, you know, the list of names you just mentioned, John, you know, the Headhunters, the Bushwhackers, Intercity Firm. And these clubs would play in European competitions and then the European Cup, which is now the Champions League and the UEFA Cup and the Europa League and so on. And fans of other teams would see them and they would see this sort of hooligan culture and sort of absorb it into local you know, scenes. Except it developed in its own way in each given country. James Montague's Among the Ultras, 1312 Among the Ultras, is a really good book, I think. He goes around to different parts of the world and talks to the ultras, the casuals, the hooligans in different, you know, settings. And it's really, really interesting seeing the evolution from these ultras going from first the importation of British punk culture, casual culture and punk culture, and then the football hooligans, and then building on that local sort of, you know, anti-authority, anti-state, all cops are bastards, 1312 attitude. You know, you see it in Italy, you see it in France and Germany. It's very us versus the world. It's us versus them, but also us versus the world, you know. There are really weird scenarios where football ultras will fight each other, but then they'll also form truces and pacts to fight the cops, to fight the state, to fight outside ultras that are, you know, the enemy of my enemy and so on.
Mm. By the way, Amr, I wanted to ask you one thing. I talked about ultras recently, and I equated them in my naivete with what we call soccer hooligans or football hooligans. And a lot of people said, no, ultras are intense fans, but they're not necessarily connected to violence. Is that right?
Yes. So that's something I noted immediately when you talked about making this episode. I want to distinguish the two. I want to set up the thing with what words are what. Yes. First of all,
we should say John and I know very, very, very little about this culture. And it's important. It's an important story. So, yeah. So talk to us like, you know, we're the proverbial five words.
I'll try. I mean, I'm not patronizing by default, but I'll try to be. So first of all, I went to a baseball game yesterday, as I was telling you before we were recording. And the one thing that stuck to me was how family-esque and like generic the atmosphere is, the environment, the fans in particular. And the reason I say that is because football in Europe, in Latin America, in the rest of the world, the non-North America, there is a very distinct separation between home and away fans. And there is a big culture, especially in England, but also in parts of Europe, and especially during international, like as in like a club from England goes to play against a club in Germany or vice versa, or Italy and so on, of fans traveling with their team, like traveling to see their team away. Consistently, not like as a one-off, but like fans will bring 5,000, 10,000 people. Like when Eintracht Frankfurt played Barcelona, they brought 10,000 fans with them. And it does have the ambiance and the energy of a sort of invasion of sorts, you know, because the fans of an away team will come into your town. there's very specific pubs that they're allowed to drink in, because the way like security apparatus in Europe operates is like keep the away fans away from the locals at all costs. So they'll like get herded into certain pubs and they'll drink all day. The games are usually late in the afternoon or the evening. They'll drink all day. They get pissed drunk. They may or may not do things that are stronger than alcohol. I will not make any claims here, but you know, a little Charlie has never hurt anyone. And then they'll march the stadium. They'll do these marches, these choreographed marches, where they're like banners, flares, flags, etc. And they'll get into the stadium, into their away section, which is isolated from the home section, usually by rows of police officers, rows of like empty chairs, empty columns of chairs, and so on. And they'll sort of, you know, sit there. They'll create an atmosphere supporting their team and so on. And then they'll be kept there afterwards. And then they'll leave when they're given permission to leave. Now, the flip side of that, the away fans coming to your town, is the curva. The curva comes from the Italian, the curve. And every home team, every club, when they're in their home stadium, the most loyal fans, the ultra fans, will sit either on the curve that is behind one of the two goals, the north or south, usually. So the curva north or the curva sud. And there, the ultras, the word ultra is used to refer to these fans who sit behind the goals and will create, like, you know, huge banners and like choreographed flares. Mm. And you know, if you look from a bird's eye view, it will look like something really cool, like, you know, a skull or like, right, you know, welcome to hell or whatever.
By the way, are those supposed to distract goal kickers, or
it's supposed to intimidate the entire opposition goalkeepers?
No, the quarterback, the running back, the defensive line.
I know the
strikers, right?
You have a point, except it's not just the striker. It's about rather intimidating. Creating fear, creating confusion in the entire visiting team, the entire visiting club, the team, etc.
And psyching up your side as well.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know, yeah. Home advantage is very real in football. It is very real. Like, yeah. You know, and it goes beyond just like the stadium flares and so on. Like, fans will find out what hotel a visiting team is staying at and will stand outside that hotel all night with drums and flares and keeping the team up awake and so on.
Oh, I wish I could remember the details, but there was a Central American war. I forget which countries were involved.
Oh, yeah. Is it Honduras and El Salvador?
The soccer war.
Yeah. Where they paraded around the visiting team's hotel for, I guess, 2 days nonstop. And by that time, the team didn't even want to play the game. They just demanded an escort of cops to get out of town alive.
That's a win, man.
That's how home advantage works in football. You know, you go to, it's an enemy territory. It's you know, there's quotes of players from England going to play against Turkish teams in Turkey, in Istanbul, especially Galatasaray and Fenerbahce, and like describing how like we couldn't even hear each other communicate on the pitch by the noise around, like the flares and the drums and the fireworks and everything. And it's very, you know, it's very animalistic in a way, you know.
Is this always been the case, or like when did ultra fans get that activist? Because I'm just comparing them to NFL fans, you know, being the home team in a lot of places is a huge advantage too. They make tons of noise. They psych up the home team and can drown out the opposing team's ability to even call plays. But it ain't nothing like this, like what you're describing. Yeah.
It started, I would say, in the 50s and 60s when it was actually brought in ultras. And so I want to go back to what John was saying about, you know, being told that ultras aren't the ones that do the fighting.
Right.
That's true in the sense that ultras are the ones that do the singing, the chanting, etc. Casual / hooligans are the ones that do the fighting. In England, the organizations to which hooligans and casuals belong are called football firms. So each club would have its firm, and the firms would organize fights with other firms. And I say organize in a loose capacity. Sometimes it's more organized, where like the heads of firms will decide where and when to meet, and firms. They'll bring in like 100 versus 100, and they'll punch each other. Other times, it's just you go into town following your team on an away trip, and the home side's firms will ambush you and beat the crap out of you as you walk through the streets and so on. To your point about Ultras, you know, where it came from, the sort of noise and the flares and whatnot, it started in Latin America, actually. It started with Latin American torcidas in Uruguay in particular. And then it spread to Argentina and Brazil. And then during the World Cup, Brazil hosted in, I believe, 1950. Yeah, the 50 World Cup. They were observed by Europeans who then took that stuff with them to Europe. The torcidas of Uruguay and the Barras Bravas of Argentina in particular were very, notorious for the atmosphere they create. And the flip side of that atmosphere is the flags. The flags are the most important thing. Fans will spend hours and a lot of money and energy and resources into designing unique flags for their clubs. And the biggest humiliation a given ultra group could have is to have that flag stolen from them by an opposing ultras, and have that flag displayed by the opposing ultras upside down. So there's very ritualistic capture the flag style, and this is where like the violence and the ultras overlap. The ultras may not necessarily be the violent part, that's the hooligans and the firms, but there is a sense of like going to take your opponent's flags and using it as a trophy to lord over them.
Capture the flag is of course one of the most openly military mimicking games around, and the two in Civil War narratives, for example, it's like the greatest humiliation for a regiment to lose its flag, and a lot of people die. And it's a great thing to have your flag borne by 5 or 6 people. The first, if 5, then the first 4 get shot. If 6, then the first 5 get shot. So by the time the battle's over, it's been carried by a lot of people, all of whom are ostensibly honored to have been shot.
A scene in the movie Glory about that, where like one person dies, the other person carries the flag, that one dies, and then they pick up the flag. Is it Glory or is it the one with Matt, with what's his name, the guy from Election?
It's Glory. That's Glory.
I remember that scene where like one guy dies, the other rushes and picks up the flag and dies, and it's supposed to be like this big honor or whatever. But yeah, it is a very like, I don't know, like the sociology behind it is really weird. I mean, I do think there is something to the collapse of the British Empire that led to the synthesis of, you know, Latin American flags and torcidas and Barras Bravas with British, like, you know, the British disaffected male of the 70s of the, absorbing that and then combining that with football firms, with organized violence and so on. But initially it was the flags and the flares and taking their flags and displaying it upside down in your section of the stadium as a trophy that, you know, you went there, you punched a few of them, you took the flag, and it's humiliating for them.
Yeah, I remember in this Russian book about Russian football hooligans, which unfortunately I can't find right now.
Yeah, I don't remember it. I vaguely remember, did you review it?
Yes.
Yes. I vaguely remember it from that, but that was a long time ago.
Many brain cells ago. We were spending them like drunken sailors.
Because they were going to last forever.
By the way, can I talk for a second? I just remembered. So you know how we're talking about like Russia and also Ukraine? To a large extent, like the pipeline from ultras to militias to like, you know, fighting in a war or whatever. That's not new either. That's another British import, because during the 70s and then in particular the 80s, all the names you just listed, John, the headhunters, the bushwhackers, all of that, that was basically the prime recruiting pool for the National Front in the UK. Then from the National Front, it was a hop, skip, and a jump to the Ulster Volunteer Forces, and then later in the 90s, Combat 18.
Mm. Buford's book, Among the Thugs, he actually goes to a National Front disco, which has I mean, the Venn diagram of that and football hooligans would be...
that Morrissey song, going to the National.
Yeah, to the National. Yeah. And at one point, the bosses, who are the only people wearing suits at this, just say, put on the white power music. And then they all stomp around to the white power music. So, yeah, tremendous overlap. But what I remember from this book about...
Was it Kozlov Fanati?
Might be. Okay. But
go ahead, sorry.
I just remember the name of a game that some Russian hooligan mentioned. It was wall versus wall. I'm stena protiv stenu. I don't know which, but it was an ancient game in this guy's village, where every male in the village got a stick and arranged a time with the village over the hill, and they formed two lines, and they walked toward each other. And when they got in bonking range, they bonked each other on the head with these sticks until they fell down. And the guy's comment was, well, everybody needs a little war. And, you know, I think that was a very European belief that
the origins of that violence, like, I mean, the medieval villages playing football in England, like medieval football in England was basically that, like, your village versus the village down the other side of the valley. You'd meet up in a neutral sort of field, and you would just charge at each other, and, you know, there'd be some sort of stuffed pig's bladder or whatever, but the point was the violence, I think, you know.
And the interesting thing about flags that I noted is that, well, first of all, we were in Glasgow, as a lot of show fans will remember, recently. And there's a famous football rivalry in Glasgow between...
Old Firm.
Yeah, Celtic, as they say it. I think they say Celtic. And the Rangers. And this has evolved into something about the Middle East, because in Northern Ireland and in sort of Irish nationalist culture, there's a lot of pro-Palestinian stance. And the Rangers fans or ultras or whatever, reacting against that, I suppose, have become intense Israeli nationalists.
Yeah, there's always Israeli flags flying in Rangers stadium. Huh. Rangers are a very special bunch in that they're unionist, Protestant, you know, UK loyal, you know, king, monarchist, whatever you want to call them. Their home locker room in Rangers stadium. They have a picture of the reigning monarch of the UK there at all times. Recently, Liz was replaced by Charles. you know, very, very Protestant unionist, and Celtic being the opposite, Irish, Catholic, and nationalist. And that translated across the organizations, you know. For a long, long, long time, Rangers would not sign Catholics to play for them. Like, you would not sign a Catholic footballer to play for Rangers. Celtic were more amenable, but Rangers had a strict no Catholics approach. And, you know,
that means nobody from Latin America. I mean, you've lost half the great football players right there,
or half of Europe, really. Italy. Yeah. No classic. Catholics, unionists, and so on. And, you know, not just Israeli flags, by the way, John. Israelis being so, like, a lot of Rangers is you know, the fundamental thing being them being reactionary translates to, like, you know, Israeli flags in spite of the Palestinian solidarity with Celtic, right. Celtics and Palestinians. But also, you know, other flags have been seen in Rangers circles, like Rhodesia, apartheid South Africa, you know, a very special bunch.
They can pick them.
and their favorite chants include the ones I sent you, John, like the Billy Boys, you know. Hello, we are the Billy Boys. Hello, you'll know us by our noise. We're up to our knees in Fenian blood, surrender or you'll die, for we're the Glasgow Billy Boys. Billy, by the way, being a certain William of Orange.
Yeah. Billy has its place in a lot of songs, and it always is a sectarian marker. Yeah.
And so, as Jewophilia or Semitophilia, whatever you call it, that goes back. I mean, there again, that fall line, they made the Jews go to school. Well, I'm talking about William of Orange and stuff. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, right.
What did he make that? What Jews always went to at least shul.
I think it was just a way of saying they were pro-Jewish, but that would be too obvious for Marky Smith, right? So they made the Jews go to school, and otherwise they rode over peasants like you. And so
they rode over, that's the line that I think he personally was pointing at me when he says that. Yeah, they did, Marky. They really did. This. Israel versus Palestine thing in Glasgow, mind you, really escalated out of all recognition. Israeli police. Well, I'm quoting a story here from 2016. Israeli police have warned against provocation at a football match on Wednesday night between Celtic and the Israeli team Hapoel, after Scottish fans waved Palestinian flags.
And they got fined for that, by the way. The Celtics, as a club, they got fined for that. And the response was for the fans was to raise and equal the fine and donate the equal donations for Palestinian causes. By the way, Celtic fans also got into a bit of trouble with Lazio fans. Lazio being an Italian club that is remarkably right wing, like they're known as the far right club, by sneaking in a poster of Benito Mussolini, a banner of Benito Mussolini that they hung up upside down with the words "Follow your leader"
and his girlfriend. Yeah.
That's good.
Wow.
Yeah. Celtics, yeah, I have respect for Celtic. Like, they are. They occasionally they get in trouble for singing things like "Ooh ah up the raw," say "Ooh ah up the raw," and things like that.
That's awesome. It's a catchy tune. But when I was in Glasgow, people said the outright brawls between Celtic and Rangers fans are mostly a thing of the past. I put up a story that I saw while I was there about a minor brawl at a Celtic Rangers game. And they said, people don't really do that anymore. It's kind of a uncool thing to do.
Yeah, it goes back to, it's an extension of what we're saying about the English fans, being softened, the heyday of mass brawls between fans of different clubs, between the hooligans of different clubs, the mass brawls in town centers and so on, 70s, 80s, up to the 90s maybe. But what really stopped it in the UK were two incidents, Heysel and Hillsborough. And they're two completely different incidents, but they tend to be, if not misunderstood, then deliberately misused by certain elements of the press, certain elements of the elites, and so on. Heysel was a riot. It was an attack. It was a Liverpool ultras, hooligans, actually. The Liverpool hooligans attacking Juventus fans. What happened was, this was in the 29th of May, 1985, European Cup final at Heysel Stadium in Belgium between Juventus and Liverpool. And the way, again, to go back to the curva, right? When you have clubs playing in a neutral venue like this, you still have the same general design where the fans of each given club will be given a certain number of seats behind each of the goals. And then the sides of the stadium, the stands that are in between the two ends, are like neutral families, etc. And in this particular cup final, the Liverpool hooligans broke through a police barrier and rushed at fans in a neutral section. But those fans were largely Italian. Some of them were Belgian. They weren't the ultras of Juventus. They weren't the hooligans of Juventus. It was right. just like families or, you know, whatever. And those people fled from the Liverpool ultras. And as they fled, they got cornered into a part of the stadium. The stadium was like a really old stadium. And that part of the stadium, the wall collapsed on them. And that caused, I believe, 39 dead. 39 were killed and others were injured. And that led to a massive response towards the what was seen at the time a particularly British problem, the British hooligan problem.
I don't think, well, maybe they learned it later, but I don't think Italian fans would have been like that. Italians don't seem as interested in violence.
Yes, they were, because I want to mention that is less known. So the reason the Liverpool hooligans were particularly violent in Heysel was actually in and itself a response to when Liverpool went to the European Cup final a year before that. The final was held in the Stadio Olimpico in Rome against Roma, and the Roman hooligans, which were called the Fidayin, by the way, because they were particularly left wing against Lazio's right wing Eagles. The Fidayin attacked Liverpool fans. There were no dead as far as I was aware, just a lot of injuries, a lot of stabbings, a lot of punches. But Liverpool fans, seeing that the final in 85 was against another Italian team, came particularly primed for violence. For them, it wasn't like Roma or Juventus. It was, okay, we got beaten the crap out of in 84 in Rome. And now we're going to, like, you know, it's an eye for an eye, you know.
It's one of those tragic misunderstandings, because I don't think Italians would see it that way at all. Like, Roma and Torino, where Juventus is headquartered, are totally different things. I mean,
the Italian football scene is particularly provincial. Like, each city is its own thing. And you know, that the common proverb you mentioned, John, of like, we don't hate international people, we just hate the people in the village like 10 miles down south, is particularly glaring in Italy. And especially the rivalries between Napoli and any of the northern clubs, Milan, Inter, Juve. Yeah. There's one of the common chants often heard whenever Napoli comes is Vesuvia eruta tutta Napoli distrutta, which is, you know, Vesuvius erupts again and Napoli gets destroyed. as well as common banners whenever Napoli comes in, the banners welcome them as the cholera people. The cholera.
Jeez, wow.
Yeah.
God. That's brutal.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, well, that brings us to the other disaster, the Hillsborough, which is a very, very interesting case in a lot
and
of...
And very different, because that one is there was a lot of hay made to make it look like a hooligan thing, but it was not a hooligan thing.
Yeah.
So Heysel led to the banning of all your English clubs in Europe for about 5 years until 1991. So in 89, in 15th of April 89, there's an FA Cup. FA Cup is a cup competition in England between all the English clubs. The semi-final was
held can you just for a dummy again? So FA Cup is, so like in a country, all the teams will play to see who's going to represent that country. Is that right?
No. So every country, when you have football...
What's your Super Bowl is all I want to know. No, I'm just,
yeah, go ahead. So there's multiple Super Bowl. That's the thing, right? So
Only first one team can win the Super Bowl, American proverb. All right.
Only one team can be world champions in basketball, hockey, or American football. And it has to be an American team, which I love. Yeah. I love when they call them world champions. Always awesome.
Exceptional.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so football, the European kind, every country will have a league system, okay? And the league system is a pyramid in which if you win the league, you win the league. You get a cup that says you won the league. And the league system is you play each other team in the league once at home and once away. A win is 3 points. A draw is 1 point each. And a loss, obviously, is 0 points. The team at the top of the league at the end of the season wins it by points. The bottom teams in a given league season will get relegated to the league below that league. There's a pyramid system. Promotion and relegation is not something a lot of Americans are familiar with.
So every year you have to struggle to be in the top league?
Yes.
You have to basically, wow, okay.
There's no tanking. There's no draft pick. There's right. no, you know, we'll tank the season so we can get, you know, Victor Wembanyama or whoever.
Right.
You get relegated, it really fucks with you as a club because the lower leagues get way less money. Like the clubs get less money if they're in the lower league because there's less money to go around because of broadcasting deals and so on. So lower, like getting relegated from the top leagues could really fuck with the club's finances.
It's God, by now the Raiders would be in the Central Valley haymakers.
The Raiders would be playing Sunday League with like 45-year-old dads with beer pong. No offense.
The Provo Mormons.
Basically that though, right? You know, imagine if like AA, AAA, or like, you know, the G League or whatever. Imagine if like teams can go up and down through that pyramid depending on their performances in a given season. Now, each country will also have, in addition to the league and the point system and the promotion and the relegation, a knockout cup competition. This is simple. You get drawn against another club in the country. Every club joins from the bottom rung to the top league, all the leagues. You just get drawn in, and it's knockouts, right? Every round you get a knockout until you reach the, you know, quarter, semis, and then the final. And then you can win the cup competition, which is separate from the league. So, you know, you could win these two. And then the regional, so each region, Europe, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, will have a continental competition. And the continental competitions, there's three of them. They're similar to the leagues in that they're tiered. But the way you enter them each season is, if you're the league champion or in the top places of the leagues, you get the Champions League, or the equivalent in each continent. If you get middle of the league, you get the lower European competition, the Europa League, and then there's the Conference League for lower than that. And it's like, you know, you go, like, that's how clubs in England will go and play, for example, clubs in Europe and in Italy, in Germany, in France. You know, your Napoli versus Liverpool's, your Frankfurt's versus Barcelona's, and so on. And Heysel was that, basically. Heysel was Liverpool playing against Juventus in a European Cup final, which is, in terms of prestige, it's the closest thing to the Super Bowl to win the European Cup final, because that's the ultimate prize for most clubs. So anyways, the FA Cup, to go back to your question, the FA Cup is like the domestic cup competition of England. Every club in England goes in, you have a knockout competition, and then you sort of get weeded out until you have the semifinals and the finals.
I'm sorry, it's real quickly. So is the American soccer, I know we have the MLS and
which includes teams from Canada. We're in the same thing.
Okay, Canadian teams are in the MLS. Okay, by the way, I should add here, I have a personal connection. My first cousin once removed, basically my mom's twins, late twins, would be her grandson, my first cousin's son, plays in that league. He's a halfback for the Birmingham.
Center back, not halfback. Please.
I don't know. Whatever, man. You know, you people with your fancy words.
Hey, you asked him to be patronizing, okay? You asked for this.
Right. I believe he hikes the ball, Mark.
Whatever. So he got drafted by the New England Revolution out of college, I think, like a year or two ago. And he plays for a lower league down, the ULS, for the Birmingham Legion. And so, but I haven't seen any of their games. Birmingham doesn't come near Rochester, unfortunately. I think MLS team comes to Toronto, right? So
we're talking Birmingham, New York, right?
Birmingham, no, we're talking Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, that's wow, Binghamton. There's so many. I would think Birmingham, UK.
So the Birmingham Legion that my cousin Ben, his name is Ben Reveno, by the way, for anybody who lives in the South or happens to live in Alabama, and he does start for them. And so they're like kind of the AAA farm league team for the MLS, as far as for the MLS team, which is
that's the thing, right, with the MLS, though. Yeah. Like they have like AAA farm teams, but they don't have relegation and promotion. So there's none of that sort of like league system. I mean, the MLS is a league, right? But it combines some of European football's systems with like a particularly North American style where like you have to make the playoffs. You could win the league, but then you have to make the playoffs, and then the playoffs you win the ultimate championship through the playoffs. So it's very it's very North American in that sense. And then you have the feeder system, of course. And you know, the Birmingham Legion are never gonna make the MLS because they're a feeder club. They're not
So it's different. Yeah. It's more American. Yeah. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry for cutting you off there. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's okay. Yeah. So that's just to preface the
important FA Cup background semifinal information for us in our amuses. Yeah. Okay.
Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield. It's a neutral venue for the semifinal. final, because the semifinals and finals tend to be always in a neutral venue. Liverpool are playing Nottingham Forest, two English sides for this English Cup tournament. The thing is, in the 70s and 80s in particular, up until Hillsborough, there's areas behind the goal, the curves. They're not seated. They're terraces. They're standing only, the standing area only terraces. So there's not like, it's just like you just get herded in and you just sort of stand and you drink and you watch the game. But in this particular case, and this is, by the way, in 1989, which is like the peak of like Thatcher's deindustrialization, the sort of complete, like just removing anything that isn't bolted to the floor and even everything that is bolted to the floor in northern industrial towns and cities and just turning them into husks of themselves, right? So you have Liverpool versus Nottingham Forest. Liverpool's fans are assigned the southern end, which is the Leppings Lane Terrace. Now, usually you have a lot of control of police and like counting how many people go in, making sure there's like, you know, there's overflow gates that if like, you know, you get over, like if they get overcrowded, you could like release fans to other sections. None of that was there here. None of that. The South Yorkshire police fumbled the ball completely throughout the entire fucking thing. And that led to a human crush inside the Leppings Lane Terrace. And if there's many ways I don't like to die, you know, there's many ways I think yeah. about that. I'm like, that's not a pleasant way to die. Crush, and among right. the top is being in a crush, I think, yes. for me.
Like, absolutely.
Yeah. Later on, I want to talk about
drowning and getting crushed at the same time. It's horrifying thought.
Yeah. I want to talk about the Port Said massacre in Egypt in 2012. That also was a human crush in a way later on. But there is a quote there by a survivor of that crush I have here written down that I want to quote, like the feelings of being in a human crush. It is nothing. Yeah. 96 were dead. Later 97, because in 2021, someone who had massive brain injuries from 89, who was basically kept on a machine, died. And then he was added to the list of people that were killed because of this crush in Hillsborough.
I'm looking at the age breakdown of the dead, and most of them were between 10 and 40. And it takes, I mean, to be brutal, it takes a lot to kill a young, healthy person like that.
There is an excellent, excellent documentary, ESPN's 30 for 30 series about Hillsborough that I really recommend people watch. They interview survivors, and there's also video clips of like the TV cameras at that time, like panning over, and you see like fans trying to climb out, like fans from the upper terraces pulling fans from below up to get them out, and like. Humans, when in a crush, like it is just, I don't know, man. It's I've been in crowded situations before, and I get panicky. I'm the kind of guy who sits, like if I go to a concert, I'm standing behind. Like I'm not a big fan of crowds in general. Mm-hmm. But like that was horrific, and it was largely mismanagement by the South Yorkshire Police and the stadium authorities that caused this overflow, and then. After causing the overflow, not opening the doors quickly enough, making like all the overflow gates were closed. So the fans were just, the fans in the front of the terrace were being pushed by the fans in the back, and there's just no way to go. You're just standing there getting crushed to death. And immediately,
One of the interesting things about this whole story that I don't fully understand, I understand aspects of it, but only some. The British elite and media overwhelmingly saw this as a Liverpool problem. And in that sense, we have to talk about the fact that Liverpool is not just any town in Britain. It has a particular history dating back at least to the famine. And that it's a special place, and it's an especially hated place for a lot of people.
Liverpool fans during the Champions League final last year were seen singing, "Philip's dead, Liz is senile, Andrew is a pedophile." very much a bastion of anti-royalist, anti-Tory, anti, you know, London elites, anti,
yeah.
Again, goes back to the famine, goes back to a large Irish Catholic immigrant population. Liverpool fans and Celtic fans have an alliance, a friendship because of this. And there was always a sense, especially like the London elite, the sort of Thatcherite and Tory elite, always saw the North in general with disdain. But even among the North, Liverpool was particularly, seen as like the people that you shouldn't care about. No one should care about.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was odd. I mean, it was very much the focus of that. And when I look back at some of the quotes, it was like, God, that was a frightening time. I mean, you can see where the depth of hatred for the Thatcherites by people in the North really came from. Especially, there's one figure that I looked up when I realized we were going to talk about this. His name is Kelvin McKenzie, and he was the editor of The Sun, which was owned by Rupert Murdoch and by far the biggest paper in Britain at the time.
Kelvin McKenzie, by the way, one of the most horrific, grotesque sort of like a dollar store Baron Harkonnen looking guy, bald, grotesque, but sort of posh as well. He was in charge of The Sun when the coverage of Hillsborough was happening. And immediately he knew exactly how to spin it, like, you know, the Murdoch type spinning of like the Sun's headline at the time was The Truth, you know, capital letters, The Truth. And you might think, oh, I would like to know what the truth is. And the bullet points: some fans picked pockets of victims, some fans urinated on the brave cops, some fans beat up PCs giving kiss of life.
Yeah.
What's a PC?
Yeah.
Police constable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
None of this was true, by the way. None of this was true.
Yeah, well, I like his comment to his own staff in a different context was, you just don't understand the readers, do you, eh? He's the bloke you see in the pub, a right old fascist, wants to send the wogs back, buy his poxy council house, is afraid of the unions, afraid of the Russians, hates the queers and the weirdos and drug dealers. He doesn't want to hear about that stuff, meaning serious news.
Yeah. He wasn't totally wrong, was he?
No.
I mean, he's
not right either. Yeah. I mean, the vision he's created, it's one of those things where, like,
Appeal to that part of humanity and then you'll cultivate that audience.
You'll create it. By hammering it over and over and over again.
Yes.
And combined with like the deindustrialization, the collapse of the British Empire, the lack, you know, there's I don't know, have you seen this movie before? The movie called This Is England?
Sounds very familiar.
It has Stephen Graham in it. Really, really good movie. The movie's called This Is England, and it's about this kid who gets sort of mixed up with like British skinheads in the 70s. It was the 80s because it was the kid was an orphan because his dad died in the Falklands War. And, you know, again, kid, dad dies in the Falklands War, nothing happening in town, everything is sort of just ambiently getting worse and worse. And he gets involved with like skinheads and, you know, sees like the sort of skinhead racism and so on. It's a really, really good movie. I really think it should be recommended.
By the way, I think we can spare just a couple of minutes for Amr's quick football movie reviews. I saw one. I suppose we shouldn't mention Ted Lasso. We don't want to get anybody ranting or anything. But I saw one that was called The Damned United, which was really good, I thought.
I love that one. Okay. Excellent movie. Okay. What's his name? Sheen. Not the Sheen that is everyone knows is a Sheen. The other Sheen, the Welsh Sheen. He played Brian Clough in a really, really good way, you know. I don't want
to... Because there's one scene of... like, I guess, 80s football, which makes very real the fact that it wasn't just in the stands that violence was the big thing. The manager was once a great football player himself, and he it decides to do a little drill with the current team who hate his guts. It reminded me of teaching in New Zealand for anyway. And they all sort of smirk and sort of sullenly watch him suit up. And then he takes the field and they instantly transform. I mean, one of them cuts his legs out from under him. The other one headbutts him and a third one kicks him when he's down on the ground. And the point is, you know, the game has changed.
Yes. More TV money, more cameras, more, it's become more, I mean, you know, the common adage back then was the halftime talk was a pint of beer and a pack of cigarettes, you know. That's yeah. the player diet at the time was particularly hilarious. It was like you finish a game, you go to the pub, you have a few smokes, you know. But yeah, it was pretty much kicking lumps out of each other and being the more, you know, get in their faces style football. Yeah. In terms of movies, there's a movie, it's an awful movie, okay? I'm not saying it's watch it because it's good. I'm saying watch it because it's an interesting observation of what an American thinks football hooliganism is. It's called Green Street. It stars Elijah Wood. And Elijah Wood sort of moves to London and falls in with a fictionalized version of West Ham's intercity firm called the Green Street Elite. And, you know, Elijah Wood is a very soft guy. He looks like a very soft person. And him trying to look like a hard man is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. It is very, like, jarring. Like, and it stars also, what's his name? Charlie Hunnam. That's the name. Charlie Hunnam does the worst Cockney accent you will ever hear in your life as, like, the West Ham guy.
Hold on a minute. I had to watch Mary Poppins as a child, and I have three words, Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, well,
every generation has to have an actor.
I mean, it makes me think of Gangs of New York and Leonardo DiCaprio trying to be a tough young Irish street thug.
I think Green Street should be watched just as a study of what Americans think football hooliganism in the UK is. And it does have some good scenes, don't get me wrong, but it's an awful movie generally. The one quote will stick out with me, which is particularly apt as the theme of this episode, where Elijah Wood, still in his sort of, like, you know, learning about being a hooligan from the head of the West Ham firm, Charlie Hunnam, he's like, he's talking about the rivalry between West Ham and Millwall, particularly their firms, the Bushwhackers and the Intercity firm, or in the movie it's called the Green Street. And he's like, Elijah Wood's like, so it's kind of like the Red Sox and Yankees, and Charlie Hunnam's like sort of smirks at him, and he's like, "Huh, more like the Palestinians and Israelis."
Whoa,
yeah,
which is like, you know, oafish American doesn't understand ambient violence in Britain and so on. Yeah,
definitely don't. I mean, I don't know if now's the time. American football fans, you do see some violence in the stands. There's nothing organized, nothing even remotely like what you've been describing here with hooliganism, casuals, and so on. The most of the fights you see, I mean, there'll be grumbling and maybe even the odd fight between a home teamer and an away teamer if they're both wearing their jerseys or something. It doesn't seem to happen very often at all. More often, you'll see people from the same, people both wearing the home team's jersey, one really drunk, the other in a bad mood. Fighting in front of their wives or something, and like,
yeah, those videos are always hilarious because
they're hilarious. Yeah,
it takes about 10 seconds before one of them falls over and like they're just like grappling on the chairs.
One of them's falling over the chairs, and then the other,
and you hear in the background, like, Steve, pumping. Stop, Steve, let him go.
yes.
Oh God!
Yes, yeah, they're all the same. They're all the same.
That raises an interesting question: Is this stuff sex segregated? Is it
largely all... yes? It's a largely male ritualized thing. You know, if I was a PhD student, which I'm not, I would call it male ritualized violence. Male on male ritualized violence is what they would call it. I just want to finish Hillsborough before we touch on other stuff, but. Ultimately, inquiries in the 90s and 2000s sort of came out with reports, like the sort of the local version of the church committee came out to show that there was a massive cover-up by sort of South Yorkshire police, the Thatcher government, and other authorities, including the Sun, which, by the way, until today in the city of Liverpool, the Sun newspaper is not sold. It's boycotted completely. No shop carries it. No stall sells it. Yeah. Anyways, there's a massive cover-up to make it look like it was drunk Liverpool fans instead of like a failure by the police. But what it ended up doing in terms of policy was, even though, again, this was not a hooliganism issue, Hillsborough in particular, it led to insisting on all-seater stadia, but also creating a set of police responses to hooliganism where, like I said earlier in the episode, stadium bans. So if you get arrested for disorderly conduct and, you know, football-adjacent violence, you have to sign in with the police station before your team plays, during your team plays. You give out your passport when your team goes abroad, jail sentences, things like that. It's really... And this combined with the commodification of football in the UK in terms of, like, much higher ticket prices, you know, trying to make it a family-friendly, you know, product. Football is no longer clubs reflecting local identities. It becomes a market product, you know.
And how much do tickets cost, do you know, for your average British football game? Because I know America, like, I want to go see the Buffalo Bills play the hapless Raiders who don't belong in the same league. In September, and like tickets are, I knew it, but I didn't know it. I mean, it's hundreds of dollars to get a ticket.
You know the Vegas the Raiders UK, doesn't 50, seem right. Maybe they should just change the city name to Hapless.
Yes, yeah.
Which also, by the way, the Raiders, another point, the idea that a club would move cities in the rest of the world
it wouldn't make
is
sense,
something
right?
that you, like, the fans would riot. Cars would be set on fire. Like, you just you don't move a club. A club is as rooted in the community as anything else. And, you know, as far as ticket prices go, it's like a single ticket will now, in the Premier League, will cost you somewhat like £60-70, which for the core of the sort of hooligan culture, you know, the working class, disaffected male, is not something they could spring anymore. You can't just get a 50 quid every fucking week.
Right, exactly.
So the police response coupled with the sort of market forces really killed hooliganism in the UK. But that just pretty much got exported abroad. And now you have, you know, hooliganism in Europe, in Latin America, in Italy is a big one we could touch on. But in terms of one of the ones I want to talk about in this episode, Egypt is particularly interesting to me. In terms of the oldest and biggest derby in the Middle East. Derby, by the way, the term used for rivalry between two clubs, usually of the same city, because most cities have at least two clubs. The biggest and oldest one is Ahli versus Zamalek in Cairo. And again, to your point, to our point about clubs moving, right? Like was Las Vegas?
Yeah, the Raiders were Oakland. They went to L.A., then they came back to Oakland. Now they're in Vegas. Yeah. I mean,
bizarre. Something that if you describe this to a European, their brains might fall out of their ears. because so, for example, Ahli, right? The Ahli football club in Cairo. It was founded in 1907 by local Cairene elites. But the name Ahli, like, you know, Ahli, the root is like family, but it also means popular, like, you know, the people's club, the popular club, you know. It became a sort of beacon for nationalists during the Ottoman and British eras, you know. It became it had a strong allure for the urban working class. And its rivals were Zamalek, which were founded by a Belgian lawyer who worked for the Cairo Tramways Company. They moved a
what
couple
does
of
Zamalek
times.
Mean?
Zamalek is just the name of the district in Cairo that it belongs to.
Right.
But during a time after 1940-41, when it won the King's Cup, the King of Egypt at the time, King Farouk I, renamed the club Farouk. So it was just called the Farouk Club. And then it became a symbol of royalism, of royalty and royalism and like the elite, the aristocracy versus, you know, the Ahli working class who also had a strong Republican and nationalist base. The club was renamed from Farouk to Zamalek, which is the location of the club in Cairo, the Zamalek district, after the 1952 coup, the Nasser coup. But Zamalek was also an upper class area of Cairo at the time. You know, mm-hmm. It was more affluent, shall we say. So this sort of class political divide, you see it in almost every derby in the world between different clubs. There are two or more clubs in a given city. The history is largely one of an original club being created for a given class and then another club acting in opposition to it, you know.
Let's take London. What are the London clubs?
Arsenal, Tottenham, Millwall, West Ham, and then, you know, if you want to expand to like farther out of the skirts of London,
Chelsea would be a rich club, relatively
rich, and posh, unionist, yeah. Tory. I hate that I support this club so much because it is
and,
very
and
much.
And Millwall, I would think, would be originally a poor club.
Millwall is poor, working class. West Ham too. Industrial part of London. The West Ham, the nickname is the Irons because of the ironworks that used to be there. But they're, you know, the thing is with ultras culture, the 80s and 90s, the sort of the failure of the left, right? The post-79 failure, that famous year that we love to talk about. Mm-hmm. A lot of ultras, even the left-wing ultras of the time, just shifted towards nationalism, towards right-wing nationalism.
Right.
So there's very few places in the world with like an active left-wing ultra culture. But yeah, you would say that West Ham and Millwall are more working-class backgrounds. Tottenham, you know, the Jewish neighborhood of London, the Yid Army. Arsenal moved. So they moved around, but they're also they were made as a club for the workers of the London Arsenal, you know, so which is why their nickname are the Gooners, the Gunners, the Gooners.
Sorry to distract you. So let's get back to Egypt. This is very interesting. Okay,
yeah.
Go on.
No, that's okay. Yeah. And so you had Ahly versus Zamalek and, you know, the rivalries based on the origins, but also the Ahly's ultras Ahlawi versus Zamalek's ultras White Knights, you know, the usual brawl, the usual scraps, etc. But then 2011 happens, and this is something that you will see happening over and over again. The unification of ultras against a given state. And I want to just reference something here. This goes all the way back to the Nika chariot racing riots in Constantinople in the 6th century. Okay.
The blues and the greens. Chariots,
yeah, the blues and the greens, but then also the blues and the greens uniting against Justinian I during the Week riots. Yeah. You know, I hate them, but then I also hate the government, the empire, the elite as much as I hate them. And then it's a matter of uniting with your enemy against the bigger enemy. 2011 happens. The Ahlawi and the ultras White Knights, they organize a truce with one another. And they're both down in the streets fighting the police in like pitched brawls and so on. Wow. And, you know, it's hard to really discern how much of the impact of football ultras in terms of like, you know, organized violence against the police, how important it is. But I do think there's something there of like having your gang, your friends, your people that you're familiar with. When you hit the streets, when violence happens, there is a sense of camaraderie that can keep you, you know, ideology may bring someone to the battlefield, but what keeps someone on the battlefield when you see people dropping, right? What sort of forces motivate you to not run away as soon as you see the first person drop? My belief, and it's something I'm really interested in, it's ultimately a sort of like, you don't want to look like dumb in front of your friends. You don't want to look weak in front of your friends, your gang, your people, right? There's something very empowering about being part of a gang.
Well, let's go back to the first story we dealt with in this show, where this middle-aged Millwall fan confronts three young men who are armed with large knives and gets in their face and yells at them and then gets stabbed all over the place and keeps fighting. I mean, he clearly had some experience with brawling.
Yep. Yeah. Experience with brawling, experience with, you know, not like, you know, even when he gets cut, he goes again, right? Like it's experience is important, as well as like as a team, as a collective, you know, knowing when to fight and when to pull back, you know, when to push. It's very, you know, the experience that Ahlawi and the Ultras White Knight had with fighting cops earlier did come to the fore in 2011. Now, if there's one thing certain, like, you know, in autocratic countries, and, you know, I'm using the word, you know, I hate it when it's used in the journalism context because it's often used in very poor ways. But in countries where the military and the police have excessive political power, if there's one thing they have, it's a memory like an elephant, and they don't forget when a certain faction slights them, right? Mm-hmm. So the Ahlawi and the Ultras White Knight, they fight the police during 2011. Everything, we know what happens next. Now, fast forward a year later, February 1st, 2012, okay? Ahli, the football club Ahli, is traveling to play the club Al-Masri in the city of Port Said in Egypt, okay? Al-Masri Ultras, they're called the Green Crescent, or the Green Eagles. I think, the Green Eagles. The Green Crescent, something else. The Green Eagles. They have, like, the Green Eagles are particularly violent. There's a history of Al-Masri and Ahli fights and so on. So you'd expect a high security environment for this match. Ahli fans follow their team on trains to Port Said. Ahli is one of the strongest clubs in the continent, so you'd expect them to win. They don't. Masri win 3-1. There's not a lot of cops. The Masri fans, after winning, they storm the pitch, the fans, okay? And they immediately start charging at the away end where the Ahli fans are, okay? And at this point, I want to quote from a survivor of what later becomes known as the Port Said Massacre, where 72 Egyptian fans, Ahlawi fans, die in a human crush in 2012, okay? Can I quote this?
Yeah.
Okay. His name is Ibrahim. He's an Ahlawi who went on TV to describe what was happening as he was there. Quote, "We saw they were not celebrating but heading towards us. We could see the cops in front of us, but we thought they would stop them from attacking us. But suddenly we saw the cops moving and the gates opened, and the fans are coming in like a storm of people, hundreds of people. We were so surprised the gates were locked, the gates behind them, the gates they were supposed to exit from. 800 people were stuck in this tunnel, 60 square meters. We started to fall down on each other. There were like 5 levels of people on top of each other. We couldn't see a complete human, only half a human, just an upper part, a head. The body is buried by the other bodies. Just one hand sticking out trying to say help. The cops were just watching. The army were guarding this gate and just watching. I was inside the tunnel. The gate, which was locked, it collapsed under the weight of all the people. The first person who died, his name was Yusuf. He was a great hero. He was outside the gate because he went to the bathroom 15 minutes before the end of the game, and when he came back, the gates were locked. So he got a stone and tried to break the lock off the gate. He couldn't do it. He was pulling it with his own hands, and it collapsed on him. We were just waiting for the moment to die. I couldn't step because there was a lot of guys falling on each other. I was down and someone was on top of me. I had two choices. If I stand up, someone will stab me or burn me. The other choice is to step on these boys. I could hear they were killing people. I could hear people screaming for help. When they took the guy on top of me, I heard him screaming so bad, I guess they stabbed him or something. In this moment, I took the hard decision to move." End quote. Wow.
God, that would be a terrible way to die.
It's so like getting eventually buried alive, but having
the state has its revenge.
The state has its revenge on the Ahlawi because they remembered their role in 2011. And, you know, the doors being locked, the cops and the military standing by and doing nothing. Mm-hmm. There were claims that the Masri fans who attacked them had knives and chains and you know, they were armed. There were other claims that, you know, there's the coach of Egypt at the time. He's now the coach of Toronto FC, actually, funnily enough. His name is Bob Bradley. He's an American coach. He told a journalist, did you hear the story about Mohammed Abu Trika, who was the captain of Ahli at the time of the riot? And the story is one, because some of the fans managed to escape with the Ahli team to the locker room, the Ahli locker room. And Mohammed Abu Trika held one of the fans as he died. And his last words were, "Captain, I've always wanted to meet you."
Wow.
And, yeah, you know. Some of these players never played nationally or internationally again. They just retired then and there because, you know, seeing your fans die in front of you, it's not exactly you know, it's a very traumatic thing, really.
Well, let me ask you something. How did the Egyptian media deal with this as compared to, say, the Thatcherite media in Hillsborough?
Well, this, keep in mind, this was during the Morsi era. So the there was that internal conflict between Morsi and the military slash police elite over, like, you know, what would end up becoming the Sisi coup later on. But at the time, the media was initially going to blame it on hooligans. The quote I talked about, the Ibrahim quote that I mentioned, that quote came from Ibrahim going on an Egyptian TV talk show and describing his experiences, which is what revealed to the rest of the Egyptian people what happened in Bourseid, the reality of what happened. And it sparked a sort of, you know, massive protest, tens of thousands of people in Alexandria and Cairo demanding justice for the 72 who died in Bourseid. And, you know, through a long story short, justice came for the people that held the knives, not the people that were giving out the knives to those people. You know, the Masri ultras, some of them were given the death penalty, others life in prison. But the military and police lieutenants, the captains, the ranks that were in charge at the time, they sort of, the trials kept getting postponed, and then the sentencing kept getting postponed, and then eventually it was overturned and most of them are now free. So,
but yeah. there were trials. Wow, for the military. Yeah. Wow.
There were trials because that was during the Morsi era, and there was a sense of pressure by the protest that we needed to at least put a few people in the dock to, like, you know, appease the angry Ahlawi. But, like, you know, they played their cards right. The military and the police played their cards right. They hung out a few sacrificial lambs, but then they bought enough time for when the Sisi coup happened for everything to be buried.
And also, they didn't have to shoot anybody. I mean, there's a Victorian poem called The New Decalogue. It's very cynical. But there's one couplet that I think is especially apt for 20th and 21st century violence, which is, "Thou shalt not kill, but needst not strive officiously to keep alive." That is, they didn't have to shoot anybody. They just had to step back.
Yep.
And let these people
because
go.
You know, when you know that certain ultras are violent, you know that there's going to be scraps, you know, but everyone sort of expects that, all right, there's going to be security, these people are going to intervene. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is just not intervene, just take a step back and see what happens. And, you know, things can escalate very quickly again, especially with crowds, right? You get a crowd in a tunnel, the door is closed, and the people behind don't know that the people in front are trapped against the door. So they keep pushing, and the people behind them keep pushing, and, you know, 72 dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there's also that sudden feeling when a violent crowd sees that it has the enemy outnumbered. And again, there's a genuinely anti-violence song of roughly the Oi variety, which mentions this. And I always thought it was kind of a good lyric. It was, it's all in this grinding voice. We go to football matches. We always had a laugh. We always have a laugh. Always do some bugger in before the second half. We have ourselves a smashing time. We really have some fun, especially when the odds are ours. 25-1
Glorious losing.
Yeah.
Okay, but this has been great. I think we went on longer than we expected to, so we didn't get to some of the stuff we wanted to talk about, like the crazy stuff that I know you alluded to in the Balkans and former Soviet Union, you know, Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
And that's a whole nother level of...
Oh, yeah. Like, that is hooligan, the evolution, militia, like, the violence. Next level of you know, militias, you know, you give... You know, initially it's random violence, then it's ultras and casuals, and now you have, like, Azov and Right Sector, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And as we said, the Russian Vanguard Corps, those Ukraine-backed NATO-armed neo-Nazis who are now invading Russia. So, but we should do that in a future episode because it sounds like we have plenty of more material.
If the CIA need a guy at a desk that can think of something like, what if we give football ultras MRAPs and see what they do with that? I want to nominate myself for that job. That sounds like a great job.
Did you hear that, Spookies? Okay. Yeah. Anyways, Omer, this has been great again. And it sounds totally, even to somebody completely ignorant about the whole football soccer world, not even crazy about it myself. But now I feel like I definitely understand it better. I mean, I had a theory or two on the violence versus American football non-violence, except for stupid dad violence, stupid drunk mm-hmm. dad violence, but I don't believe it anymore. I came into this episode all geared up to tell you this old dumb theory of mine, which is basically that you know, American football is, and it really is so almost disgustingly violent now. It's not that the game, they actually kind of try to hit each other less and less hard than they used to, but they're so huge and fast now compared to, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, it's common to have guys 350 pounds who run as fast as, Jesse Owens or something. Like it's just, and so they're scrambling each other's brains right and left and blowing out necks and knees. And so you get so much violence worked off in the field below you that you don't really need to beat each other up in the stands. But I don't think that's what happened.
No, I don't think that ever since I watched that damned United thing, because the kind of violence that you showed in just a couple of minutes where this coach tries to take the field.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not wearing any armor.
Yes.
And a headbutt when you're not in a helmet is pretty goddamn brutal.
Yes. Yeah. And it's so funny that soccer has, we had made fun of this in The Exile. Matt Taibbi wrote a very funny classic article for The Exile years ago about taking the piss out of soccer, about how the best thing a soccer person can do, a soccer player can do, football player, European, is roll around crying like a baby in order to get a flag thrown, which is just like the ultimate unsportsmanlike thing, but it's like considered a great thing. But of course, now they do this in NBA as well. In fact, there was just an article in the NBA. It's just really, I find all this kind of shameful. Like in the NBA, they call it flopping, where you put on this big show to get a technical or something thrown.
Yeah, but it's
a very violent sport. Football, global, Europe, whatever, world football, is very violent, and the culture of violence around it is something completely separate.
The theory that I work with is that with North American sports, they're not clubs, right? They're franchises. That was franchise, mm-hmm. right? So there's no way by which you could express social and cultural grievances through the franchise, because it's a franchise, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in Europe and in Latin America and in, Africa, Asia, the club is a part of the community. It's a vehicle that could be good. It could unite people in good ways for social causes and so on. But it's also a way to express grievances against, regional, the capital versus regional towns, grievances within the capital, racial grievances, ethnic grievances, which is, we'll talk about in the Balkans in particular, it's a way for social and political currents that would otherwise, there's no other place for them to go, because most of the political scene is an environment is pretty much shut down. The terraces and then the violence around it, the ambient violence around it, is where they go. Versus in America, I guess it translates to like culture wars and shit, mm-hmm. Banning books in libraries, or like the right wings, going armed to like a library to protest a drag show or whatever.
I have to say one other thing, and I know I hate to waste time here. I know we've done enough, but there's something about the people that doesn't translate to America. Like the bar in The Simpsons is the one fake touch. Homer doesn't go to any bar. There isn't that. And there isn't a larger unit than the family in that classic suburb.
That's the next door app, I think, where hooliganism among, older people. I mean, God, next door app is like the most, it's where all the fascism kind of comes out. I don't know.
Yeah.
People know the next door.
We live in
it's
hell.
Pretty crazy. We do live in hell. Yeah.
On that happy note,
I think we can end this. Thanks again, Omer. That was great.
Thanks. That was really entertaining.
Thank you.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, bye. Thanks, Amr.
Bye, guys. Thanks for having me.